Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. Once again, we are talking about how recruiting works, this time with Mercer head coach Ryan Danahy. Coach Danahy, first of all, thank you for joining.
You bet.
Second of all, we're recording this on Sunday morning, August 24th, and I don't like to talk about topical things in this podcast series because so many Inside Lacrosse podcasts are topical, right? Like, we're either talking about games on a Friday that happen on Saturday or Sunday, or on Monday morning we're talking about games on Saturday that you know, there's a very small window of relevance. Whereas this series, like, I got a message a couple days ago from a dad who was like, I just listened to all 30 dating back like 3 years or whatever. But with that being said, it is August 24th. This is going to run on the morning of Monday, August 25th. And we just had what may have been the most epic Friday and Saturday night of lacrosse in August ever. And I know that there's one aspect of this that we're not going to be able to talk about, that being the men's U20 championship. You're in the midst of your no spoilers rewatch. It's the third quarter. I wish that I could go back to where you are right now. It's like talking to somebody who has never seen The Wire or something like that.
I feel like you're getting real close to a spoiler here, Terry, because it seems like this is going to end epically, and you got to knock it off, Terry, because I'm excited to finish this off. It is only 1-1, and it is the third quarter, but I know it's probably going to be just as epic as the first run that they had earlier.
Then let's steer toward Man, Minto, or PLL semifinals. I mean, like, just so much lacrosse this weekend. It's unbelievable.
I know, and you got to have a real huge bandwidth to handle it all, Terry, and I know that you do. It's your job. I know as a college coach, we are now nearing September 1st, which is obviously the reason why I'm on this thing. So I am in the office catching up on phone calls and everything else. At the same time, I couldn't agree with you more that last night was an epic night of lacrosse, whether you're watching indoor, outdoor, or Mercer football that got canceled because of the FCS kickoff lightning delay in Montgomery. So that was a bummer. But the PLL semis, I've become, ever since Andy Towers was hired in the very original casting crew of coaches, I've been a huge diehard PLL fan. Plus, of course, my relationship with Mike and Paul. And so from that standpoint, watching the games last night, it was awesome. What was it? The Redwoods, I think, were down like 5 goals, came back, pulled it out. And
the Water Dogs.
The Water Dogs, thank you. The attack line did an above average job of putting the ball in the back of the net. But I do think that there's an electricity going on, especially in the playoffs and the PLL. I just love watching like do or die lacrosse or sports in general. But it was pretty cool. And unfortunately, I could not stay up long enough to watch the 11:55 face off here. But I am watching it now, and it is living up, even though it's 1-1, it is living up to all expectations so far. So
the PLL quarterfinals, excuse me, they delivered, man. It was,
they certainly did.
Playoff pro lacrosse, it's not to discredit or diminish the quality of the product in the regular season, but you've been as close to this as anybody. You know, when it comes down to, I've played, 10, 11, 13 weeks for one opportunity, you can feel the way in which everybody takes a step forward.
Yeah, I mean, just look at the Redwoods, and obviously now, with Joe Spolina, and I are very, very good friends. And so seeing him getting back into it, I actually thought he was going to end up being a head coach in the league. But a GM is actually probably the most perfect role for that guy, because he's talking about wheeling and dealing. You look at their season, I think they won, first 3 to 4 to 5 games or whatever it was. They had a really good record. Then they just tanked. They lost a bunch. And now here they are back on the upswing again. And if you look at the makeup of that team, it looks awfully familiar to a lot of the makeup, what it looked like on the club fields about 5 or 6 years ago. And prior to that, that being said, it is a really cool time of the year. I do love I've always said this. I don't even know if this is on topic for what we're talking about, but I've always like tried to convince, Mike Vrabel, let's do this thing, like do the PLL in the spring, man. Like I know, with the indoor and all that, but this is actually like the coolest part because you got crappy NFL football. You got typically like not great matchups, although college football is kind of changing that up. There's a lot of really good matchups week one here. But it is a cool time where there's kind of like a lull in sports a little bit. And here it is with the playoff lacrosse and everything else that happens to be going on, certainly in the world stage too. So it's fun to be a fan right now. So if you're not watching, get with it, grow up and turn on your TV and or your apps on your phone and get to watching because it's good stuff going on right now.
You teed up the perfect segue into talking about how recruiting works with respect to how reminiscent the Redwoods are starting to feel to the 91 Crush squad as Indonenza had a huge goal on Saturday night. But so I want to give a peek behind the curtain. I mentioned that this is year three of this podcast series. I get more feedback on this than probably anything else that I do. And I think the reason is because the relationships that I've developed with you and your peers allow for the type of candor in a conversation that just isn't common, particularly in this area of the sport where, maybe by rule, it's certainly a big part of it. And then also, by the value of keeping things murky from a competitive standpoint relative to your peers, there's just a lot, I call it a black box. There's a lot of unclarity, particularly for parents going through it for the first time relative to a lot of other aspects of their lives in general and certainly, their child's lacrosse life. And it's so important. So that's where, this whole notion started from. But I don't want every conversation to sound the same. And so as a result, there has to be a point of differentiation kind of each way. And this is the peek behind the curtain that I feel comfortable doing with you because you have sat in the analyst and newsbreaker chair before in ways that most of your peers have not. We're going to have the production meeting live on the podcast. You have been, you've recruited to the Ivy League, you've recruited to the Big Ten. You had one of the biggest jobs in the club scene when you were doing it with 3D, and now you're a head coach. There's a bunch of other layers that we can talk about, too. What is the hook for this conversation, in your opinion? What is differentiated about what you can bring to the dialogue relative to what you think a lot of your peers might have leaned on?
Yeah, I honestly, without diving deep into, more or less the specifics, I think one of the biggest things, and again, maybe other people have said this, but right now in the recruiting world, we are diving into territory unknown in so many different ways. I think that from, an evaluation standpoint, a recruiting standpoint, a timing standpoint, just a whole process standpoint, there's a lot of things that are going on right now that are creating obstacles is a terrible word, but different variables, for all of us to overcome at every level, from top all the way down. I think that for every coach now, you're going to start, and you just alluded to it, every coach has got a little bit of a different view on things, from the very top and talking about NIL to the mid-majors and, the amount of talent out there and the amount of talent still available out there, even as of 2026, and then the amount of talent, being poached at later times in the year. It is more or less like a wild, wild west kind of time in our thing. And if anyone tells you that they know exactly how things are going or how to predict what's going to happen in the recruiting process, quite frankly, I think they're full of shit. they truly are. But I don't think anyone's like that. I think everyone's kind of treading on, really deep water right now, and they're really just trying to figure it out. And it's a great time to, you know, I guess what they always say, the greatest time to make a profit is when the market is extremely volatile. And right now it is. And I think that that allows for everyone to jump on opportunities to get better as a program. And certainly we have done that. And it's just unique to see. And like you said, I've recruited, you know, Ivy League, Big Ten, and Patriot League most recently, and obviously now A-Sun, four incredibly different leagues on so many different levels. And every league has a niche, and every school has a niche in this process. You know, it's a lot of fun to navigate, you know, the unknown. And certainly, the more equipped, the harder you work, the more successful I think you're going to be in the end.
Let's start by asking the same two questions that we begin all these conversations, because they are so useful in terms of setting the baseline. The first is, it can feel like a silly question, but I think that it's important. How important is recruiting to you philosophically and your program?
Yeah, that's so I'll actually give you the big picture. I believe in four things as a as the head coach of this program here at Mercer that you need in order to become a very successful program, team, or even company, in my opinion. I could be totally wrong, but I think that it's required of you to have a vision. So if you're the leader, the CEO, or head coach in this this instance, you've got to have a vision for what every aspect of your program looks like, right? Then number two, and probably even more important in that, is you got to have a culture within that program in order to succeed. Number three, you need talent, which is the exact thing that we're kind of diving into. And number four, you need good coaching, good leadership. I kind of put that all into the same bucket. As coaches, we're required to lead our team, and obviously, you're going to be required to build leaders amongst your team. And so, when you ask how important recruiting is, literally, it's number three, if not number two, overall. And if you go backwards, you know, you can have a vision, you can have great culture, you can have great coaching, but if you don't have great talent, you ain't going to win. If you have great talent, great coaching, but zero culture and zero vision, I don't believe you're going to win. The only formula that sometimes wins, but not on the consistent level, is you know, great culture, great talent, but not great coaching. That sometimes gets you a win, but it also tells you just how important talent is, because no matter what, in order for you to win, you need great talent. And so for me, recruiting is the backbone of everything we do. And I would probably suspect that many others, if not almost all coaches that you've talked to, probably say the same, but it really is everything. We will not stop to recruit the best players and people out there, whether that's our coaching staff, whether that's you know, the players on the team, and certainly transfers in the transfer portal.
Yeah. So I just want to address the point, teasing a little bit. So in scheduling these going forward, I texted one of your peers, and he replied. I'm not going to say who it was because I hope we can get him on to have this conversation. But he said, "Thanks so much for thinking of me. I'm a big fan of that, and look forward to getting involved. For recruiting specifically, I'm not sure I'm passionate or opinionated enough on the topic to add much value." I was like, "Well, just by virtue of saying that, I can tell you that the conversation is going to be interesting." So hopefully we can suss that out a little bit. It's I'll acknowledge that there's a little bit of nuance there relative to saying it's not important. But with that being said, and that's an incredibly well said baseline. How do you describe yourself as an evaluator?
Look, I think that, and again, it comes to my experience, right? And I do have a unique experience, being that I've come from many different leagues, and even, you know, my 3D days, right? Like having that year to almost, you know, 2 years within the club world, seeing kids, coaching kids, you know, at various age levels, seeing them develop, and two, like there's a natural bias to any sort of recruitment. There's a bias to where they are and just from your bread and butter areas, places that you're super successful. So there's that. Places or with people and programs you have great relationships. So there is a bias in that aspect. But in terms of evaluating, I say this all the time, and I even say it to my staff. Like, I could take my mom, who doesn't know very much about lacrosse, sit her on the sideline and be like, all right, pick out the best player on the field. She's probably not going to have too hard of a time to do that. Like, she's going to be like, that kid right there. And it's like, well, that kid's going to X university. Great job. Like, we already know that person. And so you really have to scoop deep and do a lot of deep analysis. And you got to find the aspects in a player that you love. Like, what are the things that you want from players in your own program? What are the things that you're missing from players in your own program? And then what can this person or, provide you within the holes, in the future holes you're going to have? But can you coach that? Like, that's what I often say. Like, look, all the things that that player is deficient in, I can coach those items, but that I can't coach. He does it naturally already. And so from that standpoint, how good of an evaluator? I feel like I go out there and I just find and, kids, from various different positions within positions, and find the diamond in the rough, right? And because, again, we're in a position where we don't necessarily, like, I make fun of, like, the big-time programs and say they don't go through the recruiting process. They go through the pick-em process. Like, they right. pick dudes out there. And we don't have that luxury, and that's okay. 90% of all Division I lacrosse doesn't have that luxury. So for us, find those guys. Spend the extra couple hours on the sidelines, go to that weird event, that one-off event, because you might find that one kid and then he's going to pop up. And then when we find that kid, we got to see him more often, which is tough to do. But these kids, fortunately, unfortunately, play 4 million games a summer. So you're probably going to be able to see them again, or we'll make the effort. But it, from an evaluation standpoint, I do think it comes down to just a lot of hard work. And I know that sounds obvious, but there are a lot of coaches that aren't willing to do that and sit on a sideline for 12 hours in 108 degree heat, and the older I get, honestly, Terry, the harder it gets. I'll be very honest. But at the same time, like, when I get tired, and I tell our guys stories and stuff from, like, even CEOs, like, and I told them about the Dyson guy, what a great story he is. But he was like, just when you're tired, that's the very moment that you got to push yourself a little bit further, because if you believe that luck is around, you got to go find it. And the only way to find it is to push through the toughest times, because everyone else is saying the exact same thing, but everyone else, a lot of times, just start to fall back. So, I think that, from an evaluation standpoint, I think that we work hard. And so I do my best to get out there and evaluate as best as I can. But it does come with getting as much information. It comes with getting as many, eyes on as possible. And it's getting as many comparisons as possible. And I think as a staff, we've come to a great point right now, 3 years in, where we feel comfortable where we are.
Handful of follow-ups. So the first sure. is, more specifically, and I am so curious about this because of where I fall. I think that evaluation is somewhere on a spectrum where lacrosse skill and the correlation between lacrosse skill and production matters most to you. And the other end of the spectrum is athletic ceiling. There are some of your peers who think, I can take whatever ball of clay and coach him up in terms of how to play lacrosse as long as he's a great athlete. And there are others who say things like, those hands, those wrists, those, you can't coach those. So I'm willing to sacrifice athleticism for somebody who has that. So where do you fall on that spectrum? But hold on, because I want to ask a couple more. You brought up seeing sure. guys multiple times. What's the value of seeing multiple times relative to the value of how frequently maybe your snap judgment is just right, right? You saw it the first time, and the second, third, fourth time only served to talk you out of what you thought was your kind of gut instinct. And then the third element is how do you feel about evaluating different positions on the field? Like, which are the positions you feel the best about, and which are the positions you feel the least confident in?
Yeah, I think I'll start with the first point, which was, and forgive me if I'm not translating this correctly, but athleticism versus skill. Yeah. I think that, that's a great question. And it's, And it's really difficult, you know, obviously, as you see an incredible athlete, well, what position is he playing, right? And I do think that a lot of this has taken experience too. Like, we've all been there where we're just like, oh my God, that kid's, you know, there's him and then there's nobody else in the sport. He's compared more to like basketball players, you know, who are incredible athletes, right? So from that standpoint, we've taken those guys and then they didn't amount to much. And so and then the opposite, where you had a guy who isn't super athletic, but man, he's skilled, and all of a sudden he's putting the ball in the back of the net more frequently. And so you got to figure out those things based on position perspective, based on, you know, all right, well, if he's not necessarily, you know, if you're going to be athletic, then I do think that there's a sense of athletic IQ that has to come with, you know what I mean? You can't just be so athletic that you don't know, you don't have spatial awareness or just some sort of athletic IQ, then you're essentially useless. You can run fast, you can, you know, be lateral, but, you know, when it comes to being able to play within a team offense or defense, you're kind of at a loss. And so, and can you develop that? I think IQ, as much as we do a naturally great job as college coaches to do, I do think a lot of that is from just the opportunity to play at a higher level and more consistently for these high school kids. And so you really got to figure out, like, what are you good at? What does your system allow for? And, you know, is there a self coaching kind of tool and mechanism within your program? For instance, you know, I remember the teams, you know, when Duke won their three-peat back in the day, I felt like they always started a freshman in some way capacity on the offensive end. And I thought that there were plenty of other seniors and juniors that were probably just as good, but because they had four of the first team All-Americans in certain positions, they could afford to put younger guys in maybe less, you know, equipped positions to be able to, you know, take that role on and advance within that role. And then you've got other guys that, you know, we have to put this guy into the mix and throw him into the fire early because we don't necessarily have another guy that looks like that. So from an athleticism skill perspective, I do think it comes down to the position. Bottom line is I do you can't coach athleticism. You really can't. But I also think it's very hard to coach IQ within athleticism. I do think there's an advancement all the time, but there is that. And I do agree with the people who talk about skill, and there is a difference between shooters and scorers. Scorers know how to put the ball in the net. Shooters can just shoot it hard, shoot it often, create their own shot. But what is the actual result in the end? So from an athleticism skill perspective, that is, I don't know if you'll ever get a really good answer on that one, because it is tough and we have to balance that at all time. The second question, I believe, was what help me out.
Seeing
there,
you guys, Terry. Multiple times.
Yeah, so I love this question because I also, you know, we have a staff meeting before we go out on the road every summer, and I talk about it a lot because I found myself either two ways, and you only mentioned one way, Terry, where like you mention it where you can, you know, convince yourself that he's not good enough, but then there's the other way where you can convince yourself he's better than he actually is. So like the more there is a cap on the amount of times. And I do think that once we as a group, and this is why it's not just one person getting an evaluation, it's your, you know, multiple staff members also agreeing, then we will make a conscious effort to be like, get off that field, like go see somebody else. We are good. It's not just me who thinks that, it's you who thinks that. And oh, by the way, my D coordinator, if we're looking at an O guy, I'm going to send him over there just to say, hey, look, you know, do you agree or are we out of our minds? What are you seeing? And he might even have a bad day. I think this is another thing too. Kids get so bent out of shape with having a bad day, but it's like any statistical anomaly. Like if you play great for the last three times and you couldn't catch and throw on the fourth time, I'm not even taking that into evaluation. I'll say, oh, hey, fellas, he's playing like garbage right now. It might, and we say it all the time. Well, it's probably because the 15 events over the last 12 days and the 38 games he's played is probably catching up to him. So that we all take that into consideration. But there is I do think an art even to that, right? Being able to see a kid enough times, but also avoid them so that we're not doing one or the other, convincing us one way he's better than he actually is, or convincing ourselves the other way where he's not as good as he is when he really is. And, you know, you're just playing mind games with yourself. So, you know, I do think that, you know, from our staff perspective, we've done a really good job of, you know, being able to kind of take the good and the bad and mix it together to get the best evaluation possible. But I know for a fact other teams and programs are doing the same thing. So there is a little bit of an art there. And then the third piece, Terry.
The third piece is how comfortable you feel evaluating certain positions versus the other.
Yeah, I think this is probably, you know, indicative to how you grew up playing the game of lacrosse. You know what I mean? Like, naturally, I was a unique offensive player in my time. You know, I started off as just like a big shooter, ended up becoming a better dodger over my course of my college career. And actually, believe it or not, I think I was playing my best lacrosse after college, right? And so I think we all have our basic, you know, natural self-evaluation that portrays into how they view and see players on a summer-to-summer basis. And so I think naturally I have a better eye to the offensive guys. And certainly over the amount of years, I've gotten far better at looking at the nuances and defenders. And now, you know, you got Greg Gorinlian with the Faceoff Academy. Somebody's got to step up and create like the Short Stick D Mitty Academy right now, because that might be the most important position right now on the field in our game. Look at all of the, you know, national championship teams, and you can point directly to one or two short stick D middies. Let's go back to Loyola when they won it. Those two dudes were ridiculous. I think his name, McNamara, and of course, Josh, just ridiculous D mids. Their defense just stood around all game. Like, they didn't really have to do much. You don't get run by, you don't have to do much. And so between that and the transition game and the shot clock, like, short stick D middies have become an incredibly valuable piece. So the hardest position on planet Earth to evaluate, in my opinion, is a face-off guy. You know, it's constant rock, paper, scissors. You know, it's funny. We used to joke around when I was at Bucknell, and we would look at the face-off guy that we had, and he was about a 50 percenter. And we would look at the kid coming in, and he'd be like at 35, 40%. We'd look at ourselves and be like, great, we're going to win face-offs. And we'd go out there and we'd go 40% on the day and be like, I don't understand this. And then we would prepare all week to lose every single face-off, you know, against a kid who's 65% on the year. And all of a sudden our guy is going 60%. We're like, why do we waste all this time, you know, like preparing all week? And so I think that the face-off position is an incredibly hard one to evaluate. Check their films. They don't exactly lose very many face-offs in their films. and so you can glean a good amount from there, but you can't. It's still tough who you're facing off against. How many times did you actually win against said person? And so it's really difficult. Unlike, say, you would think the goalie position would be the same way, but you can tell a lot about a goalie. Is he well ahead seeing the ball before it comes out of his stick? Is he stepping in the appropriate manner? Is he attacking the ball? You can tell all those things from a highlight film. And so, albeit you're going to be wrong 50% of the time. At the same token, that's kind of how I've always felt. You know, offensive guys are probably easiest because I was an O guy. And certainly I do think that the challenge for all of us is face-off guys as we continue to go based on the importance of that position.
How do you regard your role differently as a head coach relative to when you were an assistant?
Yeah, you got 2 hours here, Terry.
well, let's talk specifically about your role as closer. How do you regard that relative to the my presumption that, like, you know, for at least a, you know, call it 66 to 75% of the prospects that you're targeting, your assistants are the ones establishing the relationship first, and then setting up the ones that are interested that you want to take for you to ultimately make the offer and get the commitment.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a kind of almost a bigger topic, right? We talked about evaluations, right? And I do think a lot of guys out there are really good evaluators, and I do take their opinion strongly if they talk about one player or another. But then there's the whole other aspect. That whole other aspect is the actual recruitment part. And this is where, again, hard work comes into it. But this is where I also pride myself in, is finding the little gaps and the little holes and the little things that make, you know, a recruit, you know, feel as though this is the place for them. And so the recruitment process and how I interject, I mean, you know, from my days at Michigan, when, you know, we were fortunate to, our two jobs at Michigan was to coach and recruit. You know, we had everyone else there, you know, administrative assistants, and take care of a lot of other things. So I could get really, really creative in the process. And so starting there, and then when I went to, you know, just observing at Penn, and then, you know, kind of seeing what the top end recruiting looks like from, you know, a Penn's perspective, and then certainly going to Bucknell and kind of comboing it all and really diving in the mix with, you know, some kids that probably in the end may not have chosen Bucknell, you know, if we didn't provide a product for them that they felt worth it. But in terms of my role, you know, and this is only my third, now going on fourth year, I would say I do drive a lot of relationships still, although now I feel better than ever in terms of my staff and them developing those relationships, especially too, as they develop their internal relationship. And I don't think this is talked about enough. Like, you talk about a kid in your head about how much you love the way they play and how much you can't wait to talk to them in September, because you're hoping that that feeling is mutual. And so you love all these things. And so when you're able to talk to a kid, you're passionate about the player because they didn't even know that you're developing a conversation with them in your own head, just based on how many times you've seen them play. And so, you know, I think that every staff is coming into their own, but I do inject myself quite frequently in the recruiting process. I know some head coaches don't, and there is a strategic aspect about that too. I've, you know, empowered my staff to do exactly what we're talking about in terms of developing relationships, and they've done a great job. But at the same time, and Andy Towers told me this a long time ago when he and I were assistants together, you know, and talk about a guy who can sell and do everything. He's like, I'm like, you know, how do we lose recruits? And this is not a shot on anybody. But how do we lose recruits when I hear you talk to them? I'm like, I'd commit tomorrow if you were the one, you know, in the recruiting process. And he goes, ultimately, who cares what an assistant coach has to say? It's the head coach ultimately that matters. And again, not to say that we lost recruits because of the head coach at the time. That's not what I'm trying to say. Is it's just, it goes to the importance of how involved and how much energy you do put in a recruit as a head coach. And so finding that balance, because in the end, if as a head coach, you're just responsible for so much. If you're spreading yourself thin, then you can't give the juice that you need to when the time comes, whether it's a recruit or how about this? We got practice on Monday, by the way, Terry, you know what I mean? And so
no doubt.
And as much as recruiting is the backbone of our program, I'm not going anywhere unless the product on the field is legit. And so from that standpoint, you know, it is important. It's a full staff effort. But in terms of my involvement, I do love the recruiting process. You know, I'm not married, so, you know, I don't have kids at home. I got a 20-year-old in college. And so for me, you know, as much as standing on the sidelines for 12 hours a day, I might still do it for 8 to 10 as opposed to 12. But when it comes down to getting in a car and going to see a kid and his family at their house, I'm going to do it. And if it goes to getting on the phone and making 10 phone calls, whether it's club coaches or 10 phone calls to recruits, I'm going to do it. Because again, it just shows you how important talent will. One kid, everyone's looking for the Jameis Winston, you know, Cam Newton at Auburn. Like, they literally changed their program overnight. And, you know, the Peter Baum stories at Colgate are no different. And so we're all looking for that one guy. And because one guy can change the course of a program forever.
I love that all of your lacrosse references are from like 2008 to 2014, because that is like absolutely my wheelhouse.
Well, it's like I'm trying not to go way back, and then I'm trying not to be too relevant in the
now. No, it's the sweet spot.
And I just want to be very clear. I say this all the time, not that this has anything to do with this conversation, but I do think that I played in the worst decade of college lacrosse in history, which is between 2000 and 2010. I don't think there's a worse decade of what the game looked like, from horns to substitutions to slowing it down to 6-5 scores. So, but yeah, no, I, you know, everything I kind of relate to is kind of in that wheelhouse because they're just far enough away. But I do think from kids who are growing up, probably can reference some of it at least as they're going through their own process.
My assumption is that geography, being in Macon, Georgia, is the most significant differentiating factor for Mercer. Is that a good assumption?
It's a very good assumption, and you know, there's it's actually kind of weird because people don't necessarily know this, but half our team is from the DMV area, and then the other half is exactly where you would expect it. You know, Georgia, Florida, Carolinas, you know, and then all the non-traditional area places as well. And the reason being is that we kind of have a weird connection to the DMV area. Macon itself has a extremely small airport. In fact, it's like a 1985 airport. Like, there's no security. It's really cool. But there's two flights a day, and they fly directly to BWI. And so it's a 30-seat jet. And so for families, when we're getting through this process, and I do think this isn't just me, there's a lot of schools that, you know, are running up against this hurdle where, you know, if you can get a kid on campus, your odds of landing them are exponentially higher. And so for us, our biggest hurdle is getting them on campus. Because when you get here and you see the $25 million facility and the $14 million field house, and you realize, you know, we have carte blanche and a lot of resources that certainly from a top 10 FCS program, football program gets, we get all of it. And so we're fortunate in that aspect. But to tie in, when I tell a family, hey, just so you know, you might want to go to that school in Northern Jersey, but I can get you to my office faster than you can get in your car and drive to that, you know, Middle Jersey, North Jersey area if you're in Baltimore. You know, it's funny too because that flight actually changed in May. And so while a majority of our guys are from the MIA area, it's now not BWI, it's Dulles. So we've kind of switched our recruiting focus to the WCAC and IAC kids. And so, you know, we've made some really good ground, you know, swells there. But it's funny, there was a kid who committed to a school 3.5 hours from him in Virginia. And I wanted to get on the phone with them and just let them know that, by the way, you can get to my office because you're 20 minutes from Dulles faster than you could within the same state that you're in to get to the school that you're currently committed to. And so it's just pretty neat how geography has played a role in it. But I always say, you know, and I do think club coaches and high school coaches are doing a great job of keeping kids' minds open. I think that that's really important. But I was no different, just so that they know, I was no different than they were in terms of, you know, what is Mercer University? And if you don't grow up outside of that, you know, East Coast lacrosse bubble where anything outside of that bubble doesn't exist, you know, I was probably raising my hand. I was just the same way. But, you know, here I am in Macon because I was exposed to this pretty incredible place that gives our guys such an incredible experience. And so, you know, from that standpoint, yeah, geography plays a role in it, but we do have some pretty easy avenues to get families down here to see this place firsthand. And it's been cool to see their reactions because otherwise, if I didn't force it on them, I'm pretty good at being a bully, Terry, sometimes. If I don't force it on these families, then they won't, but they're appreciative every time when they do come down here.
You've mentioned NIL a couple times, and with respect to the prominence of the FCS football, how has that intertwined? And I know to your earliest comments, there's so much uncertainty with respect to house settlement, post-house settlement, how it gets implemented, the opportunity to opt in and pay athletes directly, and what that looks like. But what are the early returns?
Yeah, you know, quite frankly, I think, you know, one of my biggest things and is just making sure, you know, we are funded well as a program just from our daily, you know, but yearly budget. But my thing is in order for us to give the experience that our guys need, we have to significantly upgrade that through fundraising. And we've done a really good job of doing that. Our guys feel like, man, this is this is a D1 experience right now. So we've worked really hard in that aspect. But in terms of, you know, schools like Mercer, and I guess I can only speak for Mercer, but I do think that there's probably some significant similarities. You know, look, if you've got people out there that are willing to put up, you know, the resources, I do think that schools like Mercer are open to providing, you know, NIL opportunities. It is not right now being 3 years in as like kind of a focus for me. However, you know, if it does, you know, make a difference between getting a guy and not getting a guy, and I would probably speak mostly to like maybe the transfer portal, because one of the things that's hard for, say, you know, boosters of some sort, whether that's, you know, parents and families or alums, you know, one of the things that they have a hard time is understanding how good, you know, short of your rankings, Terry, like how good is this player in high school? But what they can do is see a kid in the transfer portal who put up 105 points for X university. They can actually go and watch those games and be like, wait a minute, I have an impact on that. Like I can help you recruit that person. It's like, well, yeah, if you open up your checkbook, hell yeah, you can. From our standpoint, you know, not that we haven't had success in the transfer portal, because we have. I think from a big picture perspective, we're looking to win the freshman portal. I do think that, you know, incoming recruits, there's so many great players out there. Like, you know, we're still in conversations with our 2026 class and recruits in the 2026, you know, group. And so while NIL, I know, will play a role at some point in my career here, and to be honest, it's not far down the road, I just want to continue to make sure I'm shoring up the future of our program through our consistent effort and consistency and landing the talent that we want from a freshman perspective. All now while, you know, trying to explore a little bit more aggressive, you know, avenues in the transfer portal where we can get, you know, potentially some action from people who really want to see us succeed, you know, from, you know, obviously the financial aspect to support our program at the next level. So, but I do see the NIL world, you know, making its mix, and certainly the perceived top end programs in the country. I think it's great for our sport. I do think it's unique. I have a different, and this might be a different podcast, Terry, but I have a different view. I actually think the NIL world will actually benefit a sport like men's lacrosse. I know from an outsider's perspective, it's like, oh, well, everything's going to start to pile into football and basketball. But I actually think the opposite. And I've come from some schools that I have very good, at least firsthand, you know, evidence to that. That being said, you know, I do think that we are moving in the right direction in men's lacrosse. I am keeping the opinion of half glass full side of things. But I actually do think that when I talk to people about my opinion on all of it, that they become more optimistic for men's lacrosse in the future. And so, but that's neither here nor there from our perspective.
Hold on. It's part of it. It kind of is here or there. Is the baseline of your opinion the proportional volume or power of philanthropic support?
I think it's just the sustainability aspect of it all. Like you can compete at some of the highest levels in football, take FCS, right? But in order for Mercer to continue, and they probably will, you know, they're raising and spending probably around $10 million for their football team. And they had a hell of a season last year. They won the SoCon. They had a great outing against UC Davis last night. They started slow, but they started coming back. They were knocking on the door. It was 17-23. So, but when you talk about programs, in order for Mercer to continue to stay at the top, you're effectively going to have to double that. And when double that in commitment. So if it's not 10, now it's 20. And so where does that number stop? Where does it keep going? And what is your return on your investment? And I look at men's lacrosse as one of the sports, you know, across the board at all institutions here, especially at the Division I level, that is actually returning an investment on so many different levels, from loyalty to the institution 5, 10, 15, 20 years out, to giving back to programs 5, 10, 15, 20 years out, to the fact that, yeah, sure, we don't have a full slate of 48 scholarships, but that would mean that 30 or so of your program's players are coming in full pay, which in a sense is driving revenue for an institution. And so you know, from us, you know, I feel like, you know, a lot of teams are like, or a lot of programs are like, oh, how do you stand within, you know, this new age of NIL? And I think Mercer lacrosse, men's lacrosse program, is in a great position. You know, we are a support. We're an admissions arm, but yet we're also performing at a high level in the classroom, and we're getting there on the field. You know, we were young last year. We're going to continue to get better and better. But I do think that, you know, from a perception perspective, from, you know, just an overall value to an institution, men's lacrosse has got to be up there as a program that's, you know, valuable enough to keep around. And but also, you know, now because of basketball and football, where do they go from here? Are we going to stop our, you know, commitment in terms of spending X amount of money? Is the donor fatigue starting to catch in? And now those same donors aren't, you know, donating to the institution itself. All these questions are raising eyebrows amongst presidents and board of trustees as they continue to navigate this. And it's a really tough situation for these people to be in, as, you know, we also go into what, an 8% decrease in private enrollment, you know, whatever those stats are, where there's just not enough kids to sit in, you know, classrooms, in higher ed classrooms right now. So I do think men's lacrosse is in a great position. I think Mercer men's lacrosse specifically is in a great position, and we provide a lot to this institution, and I think that it can only go up from here in a lot of different ways. And I would say that to other programs in my position across the country.
I totally agree, and I think that there are two elements to it. The first is that means that the internal stakeholders need to tell that story loudly and clearly. Your point about the enrollment cliff that is not only forthcoming, but also likely to be accelerated by a variety of factors, puts an emphasis on anything that gets in-person enrollment at higher ed institutions, particularly male, and particularly a significant percentage of tuition payment, becomes so much more valuable than it has been. And as Division II and Division III schools close, there's this assumption that the line of demarcation financially between Division I and those institutions is a bright line. And it might be from a survivability standpoint, but it probably isn't from an inability to maintain budget standpoint. And, you know, it's not these administrators' goal to survive. It's their goal to thrive. And men's lacrosse is a unique tool in order to do that. There's one other element of the geography that I want to touch on.
Sure.
So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. And when I moved, I went to college in Baltimore. And when I moved here, it was stark to me how Scholastic sports didn't have the same cultural cachet in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast as they did in Ohio. And I think that's also true in Western Pennsylvania. It is certainly true in California, Texas, and Florida. But I can make an argument that there really aren't many places where it is more true than in Georgia and in Southern Louisiana. And the thing that is differentiated about Georgia is that it has grown so substantially so fast that some of the biggest public high schools in the country are in suburban Atlanta. And what that means is that if you have a baseball team that has a roster cap of 25 guys and you have a 4,000 student school, well, it's the same as having a baseball team of 25 guys at a school. Well, it's the exact opposite of having a baseball team of 25 guys at a school with 1,000 kids, meaning that there's, you know, 3,000 extra kids, 1,500 extra boys who are looking for something to do in the spring. And they're disproportionately tremendous athletes, whether it's because of who they've competed against in football and basketball fields or because they are just great football and basketball players. And so I went to the Southeast Prospect Day, the Inside Lacrosse Southeast Prospect Day, for the first time in 2014, and I was gobsmacked, not just by the volume and level of play, but also, you know, this was a moment where I was paying acute attention to the racial diversity of the sport and the trajectory of doing so. And while I think there's some elements of lacrosse being expensive that's a little overstated because it really undersells the fact that football is way more expensive. It's just subsidized at the school board level. It's not lost on me that it is difficult to play if you're not solidly working or middle class. It just so happens that the Atlanta metro area is the second largest concentration of middle-class Black Americans in the United States. So as these two things collide, it's been my expectation since seeing it firsthand, and there was also leading indicators prior to that. I think Scott Ratliff is probably the most notable Atlanta area alum in terms of his collegiate success around that time. And it's only become more and more true to the point where we're getting to the moment when, and I think Denver is in this in a similar category, it stops becoming an emerging hotbed and it's just a hotbed. Your boots on the ground, how do you speak to those two phenomena and the way in which both you've been a part of it, you can and hope to continue to be a part of it, and it has affected your program?
Yeah, you nailed it. And the fact that you had eyes on this in 2014 is impressive, Terry. I did not. And I can't say that fully because, you know, that's when 3D right around that time was getting into, and that's when I was at 3D. So they were getting into 3D Georgia, and we all know 3D Georgia now, but, you know, Thunder program's been around for a while. And now you got 91 Georgia as well. There's a couple other teams here, you know, now True Lacrosse is in this area, but to talk about, you know, it's interesting. One, I didn't know any of those facts in all honesty. And you know, maybe I sound dumb because I probably should. The reality for me is that the North Atlanta suburbs lacrosse players are incredible. And I don't know how, outside of the obvious, you know, coaching that they're getting from their club, but I don't know. And I do think that you nailed it in a sense. Oh, that makes sense. Like, because if you look at a lot of the other non-traditional areas around the country, they're not necessarily getting the best athletes. And because the best athletes, again, from those high schools are playing, you know, maybe baseball, football, and basketball. But here in Georgia, for whatever reason, and obviously you just provided me with some insight, they're getting a lot of very good athletes and very high-quality players. And you can say that about any state, but one of the things I can definitively say about Georgia, and it's literally our mantra, is keeping Georgia boys in Georgia. And I can say this, this is not an egregious statement at all, but if I got all the Georgia kids to stay in Georgia, and I know that's impossible, but if I did, I have a Final Four team every single year. And I'm not like exaggerating. You take all of the guys over the last 3 to 4 years that have played at the next level or committed to schools to play at that next level, there's no question. And then look at the kids and how they're panning out. Like the age-old question, which you know, state is better, New York or Maryland? Like, and it's like, you look at and how many pan out, you look at the first team All-Americans. Oh, by the way, look at all the non-traditional areas and look at how many Georgia kids show up on that list, right? But it's not even including all the other guys that are literally starting for programs at every single top end, mid-major, low major, whatever you want to call them, they're all over the place and they're making impacts. And that's probably the greatest compliment I can give any quote emerging or current hotbed, is that when kids go off to the programs, they actually make the impact that they were evaluated on the front end to make in the at the next level. There's no better compliment to an area. And I do believe on so many different levels that Georgia has exceeded that amongst any other state outside of, you know, your traditional areas that we talk about all the time. And I never really, to be honest, Terry, I never really thought much more of, I'm just lucky to be here and I'm just going to recruit them all. I didn't really do as much research as you have, but it does make a lot of sense that these are massive, you know, schools, almost university like schools down here. And there's such a just giant bottleneck. They have nowhere else to go. And when they're introduced to a sport like lacrosse, all of a sudden they're like, I never wanted to play baseball anyway. So here I am. And so from that standpoint, I do think it's unique. And again, our major target, I mean, I made probably 16 house visits last year in the Georgia area. I plan to do the same thing this year. You know, I think like all things, it's a matter of just exposing Mercer to the same guys. But I will agree. It is fascinating. Again, I'll just say, regardless of the circumstances of how it became to what it is now, I couldn't care less. I'm just, my ass is up there on the road and into, knocking on doors. And because it is an incredibly valuable area from athleticism and talent. And if you look at the amount of lacrosse that's played in Georgia, it's not huge, but they have three solid club programs coming from this place, which is mind blowing too. And so, again, I'm fortunate to be here. There's a lot of talent that we can pick off in this state. We're active in the state. We're going to continue to be. But you're right. And it's funny that you stated that, literally 10 years ago. But it's coming to fruition, and it's getting exponentially better every single year.
Yeah, it is not lost on me that you have the challenge that a lot of institutions have, which is, if you're UMass, a lot of the great Massachusetts players want to go away to school. If you're Stony Brook and Hofstra, a lot of the great Long Island players want to go away to school. If you're Loyola Towson, UMBC, a lot of the great Maryland players want to go away to school. So it comes full circle, and you're probably in that in-between phase. So yeah, just continue
I'll
to
also
stick it
add
out.
This. This is the only thing that I'll add that I feel like I, because I couldn't, I didn't really entertain UMass when I was in school, and largely because I felt like with all the camps I went to at Peak Performance and at, Springfield or UMass, one of the two, that I felt like I already went to college there. But the only advantage that I have is that these kids are born in an area where, January lacrosse doesn't feel exactly the same
as it does
in New England. And so I do think that there's going to be a 12 to 16 month period here where some kids are going to come to the realization that, maybe I might want to reconsider my options here because, it is colder. Maybe not. But in either case, I do think I have a leg up from all of that just because we are still an option down here for those guys. And it is tough for families to travel every single week going up, because if you do go to, and I know I hate using examples, but like if you were going to Massachusetts, all right, well then, your family's going to fly up there. And by the way, if you are at UMass, they don't play very many schools less than 20 miles away from them because they don't need to. So you're up there all the time. And so that scholarship you got all of a sudden kind of depleted pretty quickly based on hotels, flights, and rental cars. So that's a little plug for Mercer.
That's why our friend Jason Breo brought the Minutemen to Atlanta 2 years ago. Ryan, I want to be respectful of your time. We're less than a week out from September 1st, as this is posted. Well, I guess exactly a week out. You mentioned that you're still having conversations with a lot of uncommitted, talented 2026s. Timing, the 26 class committed at a much faster rate than the 25 class in September and October. What does the fall of the junior year look like for Mercer, and how do you approach it?
Yeah, I think for us, there's two aspects of that. The 26 class was fast and furious, right, Terry? But guess how fast and furious July was for a lot of schools all of a sudden being like, I don't have that kid that I once committed in September anymore. And I think that the hesitancy and unsureness of the commitment process nowadays is we're treading on, we're in uncharted waters right now. And so for us at Mercer, we're staying the course. We have, 12 kids committed right now. Great. We got a great class. But there's a couple other guys in certain specific positions that we are still actively pursuing. And to be honest, I'm open to bringing in an additional guy if that person comes too. So I'm not one to close the books on any class at any time. And I'm fortunate to be at a university as high academic as Mercer is to be on the flexible end of admissions processes, certainly from a timing perspective that allows me to recruit later in this. Every single year I've committed a senior after January of their second semester. So it's never done. But here's our outlook in terms of one, I do think that it's important to recognize that when I first came in here, it was August, the middle of August of 2022 for the 2023 season. And I hadn't even had a staff yet. So it was a carnival here, a circus here for the first year under my belt. And so as we've developed more of a plan, and then coaching the coaches, right? Because oftentimes I'm getting coaches coming from different divisions. So there's new rules, new perceptions and evaluations being like, yo, dude, go get that kid. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I didn't know. Like, and it's like, hell yeah, man. So there's that. And so we are now at a position at Mercer far more ahead than we've ever been from an organizational standpoint, from an evaluation standpoint, from just a relationship standpoint with a lot of clubs. I know that I used to be in touch with these guys all the time. And as a head coach, I haven't been as much, but now I'm back to gaining just because of just catching up on process and everything. But the reality is when it comes to the 27 class, we have, you know, a group of dudes that we are going to attack heavily. And, you know, it's not a large amount of guys. It's very selective. And because of the way the process has panned out over the last couple of years, and it's getting more and more crazy as we go about this. And I do think that this might be the craziest fall, not for the 27s. Like, that's not the entertaining part. The entertaining part is how crazy this is going to get for 26s as we get closer and closer to November. And so everyone thinking that they're going to lock up their class and, you know, okay, great, but here it comes again, and the summer hits, and you're right at rock bottom because, you know, you're advancing on. And so for us, there's a target group, a group that we know we can secure or hopefully secure, and if not, no problem, because, again, we'll be right back here prepared as ever to continue to evaluate, continue to get on the phone, continue to recruit better than we ever in any position we've ever been in to make sure that we're securing the best talent possible for the positions that we need year in and year out. So we take it in a slow approach. But we're, you know, again, dividing it up as a staff to make sure as things, you know, fall through, fall forward, whatever you want to call it, because, you know, we're ready. We're ready for it. And so as kids, the only advice that I could give kids is, and we say it all the time as a coaching group, but like every process is different. But don't judge one process over the other, because again, we're going to probably commit a senior in his second semester that probably had the same thoughts when he was a junior in his fall, thinking that this process sucks. And you know what? You're right. It does suck. It sucks for us. It sucks for you. But we're all in this, you know, grinding it out, trying to find the best fits for both us and you. But it'll come to fruition. And you're going to land a spot that that you're going to love. I promise you.
Brian Danahy, this was as entertaining as I expected in hopes that it would be. Thank you so much for your time, and enjoy the remainder of the gold medal game. Text me when you finish your final thoughts.
I definitely will, Terry. Terry, thanks for all you do for the sport of lacrosse. I consider myself a servant to the game of lacrosse and to my players, and I know that you do as well. So thank you for everything you do, man. You do a hell of a job, and the whole crew over there, as big or as small as they are, they work their asses off over there. And so thank you for doing what you do for the sport, man.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate the kind words.
Appreciate you.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.